wonderful.
A second difference is really related to
Mispar Shemos. Mispar Shemos means the counting of names. The Ramban says a beautiful point. What does it mean, the counting of a name? Each person had to personally appear before Moshe Rabbeinu and give him his name as he handed the half shekel to him. Think about this. What connection did Moshe Rabbeinu have to the rank and file of the Jewish people? You know, if a woman got her fleishik spoon mixed with her milchik pot, she didn't go to Moshe Rabbeinu for those types of questions. She went to the local rabbi over the 10, over the 100, over the 1,000. Moshe Rabbeinu essentially dealt only with, of course, when he taught the Torah to everybody, but you know, you're sitting in a crowd of 3 million people, right, 600,000 men. But in terms of individuals, very, very few individuals had any personal connection to Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Ramban points out it was important that once in a person's life he personally introduces himself to Moshe Rabbeinu, so that Moshe Rabbeinu has some connection to that person as an individual. Once in your life, a leader should not just be a leader of the faceless crowds of hundreds of thousands or millions, but there should be that connection. So these are two fundamental distinctions. And I think this is very, very significant, because what it reminds us is the following. All of us know, and we've talked about this before, that the concept of the half shekel, and that's how we count, right? Jews are counted by giving a half shekel. The half shekel is a symbol of unity and community. How is that so? Because a half is incomplete unless it is joined to another half. And that's a reminder that each person must regard themselves as incomplete and defective unless they connect themselves with another, right? So the machtas ha-shekel is a symbol of unity, community, and achdus, right? We know that. But there are two types of communities that can exist in the world. And sociologists term one a model that is called a melting pot, and the other is a model that is called a salad bowl. What is the difference between a melting pot and a salad bowl? A melting pot, which of course was the imagery that was used for American society for many, many years, was people come with differences, and the concept is, let's melt them down to make people indistinguishable from one another, so they simply become a common culture, without differences, without uniqueness, without individuality. Right? If you take a cholent that is several days old, so after a while, you don't really see beans or potatoes or meat. You see kind of this mush, this undifferentiated mush, which is the ultimate success of the melting pot, right? Like you might melt your pots in trying to get it out. Now, that's one vision of achdus. That's an achdus which focuses on the obliteration and disintegration of differences in order to achieve a commonality. But there's another level of achdus, which is compared to a salad. And that would be, you put in tomatoes and lettuce and peppers and cucumbers, where each ingredient keeps its color, keeps its uniqueness, but together it forms a whole that is greater than the sum of the individual parts. You could call it a salad bowl, you could call it a tapestry, in which you have all of these different colors, but together, or needlepoint, together it forms a beautiful picture. You can call it a mosaic. Now that's a very different type of community. That's a community which does not try to suppress or obliterate uniqueness, but it's a community that draws its strength from the individual perspectives that each member brings. Now, of course, there is a risk. If you take individuality to the furthest extreme, you have no community at all. You have anarchy. Like I thought, it was very cute that if you remember when the World Trade Organization was meeting in Seattle, so there were a lot of demonstrations with people who are against this one idea of consolidated, you know, world government. So I read that there was a demonstration that was attempted by a group that called themselves anarchists, but it wasn't that successful. They couldn't get organized. You know, it's kind of very, very, very interesting. that when you take, you know, anarchists are people who don't believe in any government at all, so they couldn't organize themselves into a group, so they couldn't have any type of demonstration because they're not organized. So the thing is this. So one has to be careful, but a true unity is achieved not by trampling and not by crushing and not by suppressing uniqueness, but rather by looking at each person in terms of their own unique contribution. Now, one might suggest that in Jewish history, there are times in which we need a melting pot and there are times which we need a salad bowl. And that is, when the Jewish people face a cataclysmic crisis of annihilation, that's a time when people have to come together as a group. It's not a time to focus on your individuality or uniqueness. You have to give up your separateness for the benefit of the community. And at that point, you kind of mold together in a single, undifferentiated unit to deal with a danger. That is what we had in the aftermath of the Chedo Egel. The aftermath of the Golden Calf was a very dangerous time for the Jewish people. There was a serious risk, at least from our perspective, that God would destroy us. There was a risk that he would establish a new nation from Moshe Rabbeinu alone. There was a problem of the abrogation of a covenant that would not be reinstated. And therefore, the need to come together was something that transcended individuality and uniqueness. And thus, the census in the aftermath of the Chedo Egel stresses anonymity, meaning we don't know how many Reuvens or Shimons there are. It stresses the notion of collectivity and community that is not does not recognize the individuality of its units. However, that type of achdus is a short term. That is not the permanent achdus Hashem wants. The permanent achdus Hashem wants is an achdus that revels in the individuality of its constituents. And that is evident in the second census. In the second census, we not only have 603,000 Jews, we have a Reuven and a Shimon and a Levi. Now that is very significant because tribal differentiation suggests a unique mission, right? We know Chazal tell us each Shevet had its own unique role in serving God. Reuven served Hashem in one way, Shimon served Hashem in another way. They're all organized around a central core like spokes from a wheel. The Mishkan of God. They're all committed to that central ideal, but each in his own way, with his own flag, with his own count, with his own structure, with his own mission. You know, next week we're going to read in the Torah about the korbanos that all the Nasiim brought when the Mishkan was dedicated, and the Torah repeats the same sacrifice 12 times. The same thing. It's very easy for a Baal Koreh. It's a huge amount of psukim, and it's the same trap over and over and over again. Why doesn't the Torah just say what one Nasi brought and then say everybody brought the same? So the Medrash tells us, because although externally everybody brought the same offering, each person's insight and purpose and kavana was different and unique. All of us may keep Shabbos, but we all keep a different Shabbos. All of us may daven Shachris, but based on who we are, we bring a different perspective to our Shachris. The counting of the tribal differentiation, and Kal Vachomer, the individual person who introduces himself, highlights the notion that true community is not something that obliterates the distinctiveness of the individual, but true community is that which relishes and revels and appreciates the uniqueness that each person has to offer. Because if Hashem's Metzius is the totality of truth, and every one of us only has a fraction of that truth, then we become godly only to the extent we learn from each other's truth. Now, once again, there are going to be limits, meaning, obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu laid down in the framework of halacha certain absolute truths that are not subject to negotiation or the like, but one also has to have a sense of humility that no one individual is in possession of a totality of truth. And therefore the achdus is necessary not to obliterate and suppress, but to learn from everybody's endeavors. And therefore one might suggest that the lesson of the two countings within the span of 7 months is a very fundamental lesson, because it teaches us, machdus ha-shekel, yes, is a sign of achdus, but it teaches us that an achdus based on a blinding conformity is not the ultimate unity of a Klal Yisrael that Hashem wants to have. Hashem wants there to be a higher level of Achdus, a community that recognizes individuality at the same time. That is why the Zohar says there are 600,000 letters in the Sefer Torah, and there are 600,000 souls that left Egypt, and it is said that every soul has their own letter in the Sefer Torah. And we ask Hashem, when we ask Hashem in davening, v'sein chalkeinu b'sorasecha, show me my portion or our portion in your Torah, we're asking Hashem, show me what my letter is. Now, this isn't only in a physical sense, oh, I have the hay of Sora, whatever it is, but rather it refers to the fact that each of us has an insight. Each of us has an understanding. Each of us has a special way of relating to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And our way is not somebody else's way. And if we just blindly imitate somebody else's way, our neshama is going to be starving. Our neshama has not found its wavelength, has not found its channel. And we ask Hashem, show me what that channel is. Because it's not going to be obvious. It's not going to be, I'll always know. A person might go through many years. A person might go through their whole lives without ever really finding that. And that's why the real goal of a parent and the real goal of a teacher is not so much to put something into a child, but to somehow unlock that key or that lock within the child that enables them to discover their letter of the Torah. Chinuch, in other words, is essentially a matter of self-discovery. Now, I'm not suggesting the old experiment, you know, there was a belief in the Middle Ages that Hebrew was the natural language of man. So there was a belief that if you would put a baby alone in a room and not expose him to any speech at all, he would automatically start talking Hebrew. Now, in those days, they didn't really have too many moral guidelines regarding human experimentation. So the story goes that King James, the one who had the Bible translated, was very enamored with this idea of Hebrew being the ancestral language. So he put some kids, he locked them up, you know, for 3 years, and he gave them food, but no exposure to human speech. And he thought for sure they would speak Hebrew. It turned out they didn't. In fact, unfortunately, apparently, if a child is not exposed to speech by a certain age, it's very hard for them to even develop the capacity to talk later. So I'm not suggesting, you know, leave your child alone and he will automatically turn into a tzaddik. But there's a way in which you're working with the person's nature. You work with the nature. Chanoch l'nar al pi darko. Train a child according to that child's personality. And then he finds his letter. And when he finds his letter, all sorts of things open up. And one of the big problems we have in education, Jewish education, but education generally, but Jewish education particularly, is the concept of the one size fit all, which in a way there's almost no escape, because unless you have a one-to-one student-teacher ratio, by definition a class is being pitched to a group, and there are going to be individuals in the group who are above that or below that or have different talents or whatever. But Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say that education is often like the bed they had in Sodom. Sodom, which was not big in hospitality, but Sodom had one hotel, which was fine, but the problem is you had a one-size bed. If your legs were too long, they would cut them off. And if your legs were too short, they would stretch you at the rack till they fit. Greek mythology has a similar idea, the Procrustean bed, which is actually an English, centered English expression as well. And that's really the great danger that we face. And this could be, well, you know, I think now it's become a problem that everybody talks about, but you know, this problem is what they call kids at risk or teens at risk, is now at least it's been recognized as a very, very significant problem in the Orthodox community. When you do have, you know, kids who are not necessarily geared for the standard yeshiva system. Now, some of these kids could actually do very, very well in different types of environments, but we've sometimes created kind of a single path for people to go, and that creates a lot of difficulties. And this is the idea of the Achdus that appreciates the diversity and uniqueness of individuals.
Coming back to the two sensors, I thought sensors is a wrong thing. You get a terrible thing when you do that.
Oh, sensor?
To sensor.
No, not sensor. Census. Counting. Not. I don't mean censorship.
No, I meant counting.
Oh, counting. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, you don't count directly by head. You don't count 1, 2, 3, but you
by
give
shekel.
It by shekel. Shekel you can count.
Yeah, but they got punished.
No, not by shekel. When did they get punished for shekel?
So the second time.
No. In King David, in the book of Shmuel, yeah. They got punished for a census, but there the census was not by giving shekel. It was a head count. If you count by a shekel, you don't get.
But even today, we can't count. We say not one, not two, not three.
Well, because that's counting by heads. When you're counting people, so you
but
count them by.
But it's still.
But if you count, shekel, yeah, even today, you're not supposed to. In fact, there are religious Jews in Israel, who refuse to respond to the census, the Israeli census, because they don't want to say how many people they have in their family.
It is true. Somebody said that if you ask a rabbi what is the Omer, he won't tell you. He tell you it's before this.
No,
or
but that's a different reason. The reason is. Well, the reason is, if it's nightfall and you ask somebody what day of the Omer is, once they say what day it is, they can no longer make a blessing. They already count it. In other words, you could ask me now, because I already said the bracha last night, but if I didn't make the blessing for the night yet, I'm not going to say what night it is, because then I lose my ability to make a blessing. That's a different...
But it's nothing to do with...
No, not because of
it. So they didn't understand.
Right. Yeah.
When you knew, is it because... of what you just said about the letter that when in the part of the service on Shabbos when they hold up the Torah and they show it around that you're supposed to look at, my daughter told me you're supposed to look at the letters,
so yeah.
You can, because you may see your letter. So
I didn't hear that connection. That's a very interesting connection. You're looking to find. Of course, you only have a small part of the Torah that's
right,
open.
Right, that's why you're supposed to look every week.
But if you look every week, you'll find it somehow.
That's very beautiful.
That's a nice explanation. I didn't hear that connection.
He just said that everyone has their own letter in the Torah.
Yeah. Oh.
So
yeah.
My daughter told me you're supposed to look every Shabbos to see if you happen to see that letter.
By the way, they even say... I'm sorry, Sarah, did you want to say something?
Yes. One question is, how is the correct way to ask how many children have a family?
Well, you can ask how many children do you have. You're allowed to ask. The question is how they'll answer you.
But the question is,
You can ask, yeah. Some people will say, I don't want to say, but you know, you're allowed to ask. It's not impolite to ask.
Not one, not two, not three, not four.
I thought that the reason why you could answer, my son said yesterday at Shabbat that he thought the reason why you could count on these two senses, but you couldn't count in other situations is because the censuses were counts for a purpose. And if it wasn't the purpose, that you really couldn't count.
Yeah, the Ramban gives two explanations. One explanation the Ramban says is that a census is prohibited only if it's a direct head count and not if it's through the giving of a half shekel. The other explanation is the census has to be for a purpose and not if it's for no purpose. So there are two different reasons that the Ramban gives. Because the problem is that we see that David HaMelech counted the people in the book of Shmuel, and people died because of it. So the Ramban says either because that was just a gaiva census, he was counting to see how big his kingdom was, or it was not done by the shekel. Right, so that's the thing. Now, one thing, you know, even the word Yisrael, the Zohar says Yisrael, Jewish people, Yisrael, is an abbreviation. Yesh, Shishim, Ribu, 60 myriads. A myriad is 10,000. 600,000. Osios, letters. La Torah in the Torah. Right? So the Jewish people, 600,000 letters in the Torah. It's an abbreviation for that phrase. Yeah, so that's what I want to answer. I want to raise that question now. The Zohar makes a whole big point that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. Now, it's a beautiful thought, and you know, a lot of people have heard this. The problem is, the actual count of the letters is much, much smaller. There are only around 305,000 letters in the Torah. Where does the Zohar get the figure 600,000 letters? There are not. So I'll just give you two quickie explanations for this. Yes, that's it. Yeah, there are 300...
Say it again, please.
Yeah, there are 305,000 letters in the Torah.
300.
Not 600,000. So I'll give you two short answers for this. One answer is that the Zohar's method of counting, which we're not exactly privy to, may regard some letters as being two. For example, if you take a hay could be viewed on some level as a composite of Dalet Vav, two letters, you see? So with that type of cheshbon, you can actually get, if you start splitting up letters into more than one, you can get 600,000, although we don't know exactly what the calculation is. But there's another answer that some Sforim give, and that is that the Zohar counts the spaces between the words as being hidden letters. Because the halacha is that between a word, you have to have the space of a letter. That's how you separate words. And the Zohar is Maranes, that there are going to be many, many Jews in the world whose letter to the Torah is hidden and concealed. And those are primarily those who have not been able to do mitzvahs yet. And when they do tshuva, and when all of the Jewish people do tshuva at the end of days, all of those hidden letters will be revealed. So there are 305,000 open letters, and then you have the balance of the hidden letters. So again, that's an idea that, so in effect, you know, we say that Achdus is often compared to a Sefer Torah that's missing a letter. If a Sefer Torah is missing a letter, the whole Torah is puzzled. It's not just that letter that you're missing. So as long as there's any Jew who doesn't have their letter, our Torah is not complete. And that is why Shavuos, which is the holiday of Matan Torah, the Torah says we all have to be together, ki ish echad uvelev echad, like one person, one heart, because otherwise the Jewish people cannot accept the Torah as an individual. You accept the Torah as part of a nation, but the vision of the two unities tells us that the meaning of Achdus is an Achdus that appreciates individuality as opposed to an Achdus that ignores individuality. The letter what? Which one? Oh yes, sure. Yod is concluded, of course. Yes, it includes everything. Yeah, yeah. So that's just a thought about the idea of what Achdus is. And you know, in our day and age, even when we try to achieve Achdus, it often calls on people to kind of obliterate and merge and meld and melt, as opposed to truly appreciating. And within Torah, we know that there are many, many drachim within the framework of Torah how one approaches Hashem. And one has to be very, very sensitive to try to guide people and for themselves find the path that is best for them. Yeah. Well, that's spoken like a tax lawyer, but I have to figure that out. But yeah, that's a good question.
You said Ishachar as
well. Oh. Well, that's the question. Now, you're asking if I add up all the spaces, but of course there are more things as well. Keep in mind that not only do you have spaces between words, but you have paragraph divisions, which are whole lines. Yeah, because if a single space counts as a letter, so when you have, there are also a lot of spaces of 9 blank letters and 4 blank lines, etc. You know, so there are other types of breaks. If you look at a Sefer Torah, if you ever see, you will see there are other types of breaks that can give you that that difference.
Oh, when you take Torah down,
you know,
each letter has.
That's right. Yeah, that's true also. But even the blanks have meaning.
Okay.
Ish echad. Yeah. Yeah. Ish echad uvelev echad. We have to.
Oh,
lev
echad.
Yeah.
I didn't.
Now the other thing I just wanted to share with you is another thought about Shavuos, and that is all of us know, although the Torah never says this, that Shavuos, the great holiday of Shavuos, is the day that Hashem gave us the Ten Commandments. Right. That's what we saw. We call it Zman Matan Torasenu, the season that Hashem gave us the Torah. And this came after 50 days. You counted 49 days, and on day 50, Hashem gave us the Torah. Well, here is the question. We could prove from the Talmud that Hashem did not give us the Torah on Shavuos. Hashem gave us the Torah the day after Shavuos. We're celebrating the wrong day. And the proof is very simple. Chazal teach us that the Jewish people left Egypt on a Thursday. There's such a tradition. Now, that means the first day of Pesach was Wednesday night and Thursday. So when did the Omer start? What was the first day of counting the Omer? Thursday night, Friday. Friday was day one of the Omer. Now, we also have a tradition. The Torah was received on Shabbos. So figure this out. If counting of the Omer began on Friday, the 49th day was Thursday. The 50th day of the Omer is Friday. Shabbos is day 51. So how could we celebrate Shavuos on the 50th day of Svira if the Torah was not given until the 51st day of Svira? Now, at least in Chutz La'aretz, we get it right with the second day of Shavuos, right? We keep the second day of Shavuos, which is the day of Matan Torah, but that's only because of the calendrical doubt. Really, Shavuos is only one day, and the one day that you keep in Israel is not the day that we got the Aseres HaDibros, it's the day before we got the Aseres HaDibros, right? So L'chari, the Magen Avram, one of the great commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, asks a very simple question: how could we ever celebrate Siman Matan Torah on Shavuos if in fact the Torah was given a day after Shavuos? Now, this might answer, of course, the biblical question of why the Torah doesn't say Shavuos is a holiday because you got the Torah. In fact, we didn't get the Torah. I mean, that explains why the Torah doesn't say it. And yet we know that, to us, the primary meaning of Shavuos is Matan Torah. This is the Magen Avram's question. And the Magen Avram gives an answer. The Magen Avram says the following answer. According to the Gemara in Shabbos, God wanted to give the Torah a day early, but Moshe decided on his own that the Jewish people needed an extra day of preparation. And therefore Moshe pushed Matan Torah off one day. So the Magen Avraham says, we don't celebrate Shavuos on the day that Hashem gave us the Torah. We celebrate Shavuos on the day that Hashem would have given us the Torah had Moshe Rabbeinu not pushed it off. This is the answer of the Magen Avraham. But the question is, number one, how do we understand the concept Moshe Rabbeinu pushes it off? Hashem wants to give the Torah today.
And Moshe?
And Moshe says, no, I think we need another day. And second of all, why should we give primacy to the day that the Torah would have been given? Shouldn't we give primacy to the day that the Torah actually is given? Right? Why is the hypothetical, theoretical day more significant than the actual day? Right? So here, there are different commentaries that explain this process with reference to the famous Gemara. The famous Gemara in Rav Metzia talks about the Tanur Shalachnoi. It's one of the most famous passages in the Talmud. Tanur Shalachnoi was an earthenware oven,
a tanur,
that was cut into rings, and between the rings there was sand. In other words, it was an oven which you could take apart. It was like cut into like hoops, like hula hoops, that were piled on top of each other and were kept into place by sand. And there is a halachic shaila, which is not really so relevant to us, whether that's considered to be a whole utensil that is susceptible to ritual impurity, or whether it's something broken that cannot become tamek. And there's a machlokas. The sages took the position that it is pure, it is tohor, and Rabbi Eliezer, a great rabbi, refused to agree with them, and he said it's absolutely tamek. And he kept on arguing and arguing, but the sages refused to accept his
view. What made it tamek?
If a dead animal would touch it.
Oh.
But the question is whether it would become tamek. So Rabbi Eliezer then calls upon Hashem to do a number of miracles to show that Rabbi Eliezer is correct. First, he says, if the halacha is like me, let this tree, this buxer tree, carob tree, fly away. And the tree flies away, like a rocket. And the Chachamim say, we don't listen to trees. Trees don't impress us. Then he said, if the halacha is like me, let the river change its course. And the river reversed its course. And the Chachamim said, we don't listen to rivers. And then he said, if the halacha is like me, let the walls of this Beis HaMedrash collapse. And the walls were about to collapse. And Rabbi Yoshua ordered the walls not to collapse. And the walls were not sure who to obey. So the Gemara says it remained slanted. They didn't know where to go. And the Chachamim say, once again, we don't listen to walls. So then Rabbi Eliezer says, if the halacha is like me, let there be a voice from Shamayim to say, I'm right. Hashem, a voice from Shamayim said, Rabbi Eliezer's right. And the Chachamim say, we don't even listen to voices from heaven. Because the Torah says, Lo b'Shamayim, it is not in heaven. We have to decide the halacha. And the Gemara even says, that Rabbi Eliezer was excommunicated, the whole story. And the funny thing was, not the funny thing, but the interesting aspect of this was that the head of the Sanhedrin who excommunicated him, his sister was Rabbi Eliezer's wife. This was his brother-in-law. This is Rabbi Gamliel, who was a very, very tough Nasi in this regard. We have many stories of Rabbi Gamliel laying down the law. And it is said that Rabbi Eliezer's wife was always afraid that her husband would pray that her brother would die or something like that would happen. And indeed, the Gemara says that at a point that Rabbi Eliezer expressed his anguish to God, Rabbi Gamliel did die. But be it as it may, the Gemara recounts that someone asked Eliyahu HaNavi, what was Hashem doing when the Chachamim come up with this amazingly chutzpahdik answer? We don't care what Hashem says. And the Gemara says Hashem was laughing, Kavyachal, and Hashem said, Nitzchuni banai, my children have been victorious over me. So what's the explanation of this? On one level, Loba Shemayimhi seems to be a preposterous statement. Because what is halacha? Halacha is we attempt to conform with the will of Hashem. We attempt to do what is God's will. So now you're telling me that if God tells me what his will is, I treat that as an irrelevancy. I say to God, no, God, that's not what you want. I know what you want better than you do. I think you don't really know what you want. What you want is this, even though you tell me you want that. Now, that might be, you know, a parent and a child, you know, it might be. The child doesn't really know. But how can one say that Hashem's expression of his will is not relevant in determining Hashem's will? And if we're not determining Hashem's will, if halacha is this closed game system where you just go by the rules, then what significance does that have? I mean, isn't Judaism about living in accordance with the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So the Drasha Saran explains a very, very fundamental aspect of what we mean by Jewish truth and halachic truth. It says truth in halacha is not a matter of mathematical precision. For example, in mathematics, at least if it's standard Euclidean mathematics, just to keep it simple, there is only one right answer. There is no such thing as, you know, legitimacy of opinions on certain matters. If I say 1 and 1 is 2, you cannot say back to me, that's your opinion. Who says your opinion is any better than mine? I say it's 3. There is a right and there is a wrong. There is an objective truth, and any other approach to that is inherently false. The Ram says in halacha it's not that way, in this sense. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we mentioned this a few weeks ago I think as well, could have given us a definitive answer to every question. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have told Moshe Rabbeinu how to deal with nuclear war, how to deal with genetic engineering, how to deal with cloning, surrogate motherhood, and microwaves on Shabbos. And this could have been given to Moshe. Now you would have said, well, Hashem couldn't have done that because Bnei Yisrael wouldn't understand what a microwave is. So Hashem could have given envelopes. Certain envelopes to be opened in 5760, and then you'll read about what Halacha says about cloning, etc. Hashem could have given us the answer to every question. And yet Hashem chose not to, because Hashem wants us to be his partners in the creation of his will. In other words, the definition of truth is not some fixed answer that Hashem gave. The definition of truth is the result that the Chachamim come up with when they engage in the process of understanding the Torah. In other words, Hashem says, in effect, my will is whatever you come up with using my guidelines, even if, in an objective sense, it's not the answer I would have gotten. Hashem defines truth by the effort and the process. It's as if, for example, a teacher would give you full credit, it normally doesn't happen, for engaging in the correct process, even if your answer is wrong. Hashem, and that's why, for example, with Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, one says kosher, one says treif, which one is right? The Gemara says they're both right, although we have to follow one view in actual life. How can they both be right? Is Hashem's desire that it be kosher, or is Hashem's desire that it be treif? The answer is, it is Hashem's desire that it be whatever the Chachamim come out with, provided they're committed to the Masorah and the process of halachic decision making. That's why in a machlokas and halacha, it is normally not a question of one being right and one being wrong. Now, where do we see this? Now, that's why we call Matan Torah. Hashem gave up the Torah. Hashem, as it were, gave us control over the Torah. That's a very big chiddush. The example that they give is the baking of the cake thing, right? You can bake the cake for your child, but if you really love them, you involve them in the process. And when you involve them in the process, the cake is going to be messier and lumpier and messier, but the love is the involvement. Hashem involves us in the process of Torah. Now, where do we first see that Hashem defers to our interpretation of the Torah, even if it's wrong? We see it at Matan Torah itself. It was Hashem's plan to originally give the Torah on Friday. Moshe Rabbeinu misinterpreted, the Gemara actually says he misinterpreted Hashem's command, and he thought he needed an extra day. So what does Hashem do when Moshe Rabbeinu interprets God's command in the wrong way? Hashem goes along with it. In effect, therefore, when did Hashem really give us control over the Torah? Not the day that he gave it to us, but the day that he didn't give it to us in deference to Moshe Rabbeinu's interpretation. In other words, Matan Torah was an act of, Matan Torah was omission. We got the Torah by omission and not by commission. We got the Torah not when God gave us the Torah. We got the Torah when God did not give us the Torah in deference to Moshe Rabbeinu's understanding of the divine commands. In other words, even if he was wrong, Hashem validated. Hashem said, you're right. And that's truly Matan Torah. Now, of course, this explains that the idea of Moshe adding a day was not that he knew God meant it today and Moshe pushed it off, but he had misinterpreted God's command in various ways. And that is truly the notion of Matan Torah. God has given us the Torah to be able to interpret and to apply, and that's a sign of divine love in terms of giving us a role in the process. Now, you may say, what does that have to do with us? I mean, that may be the great gedolim, and we certainly don't sit around, you know, deciding, you know, what the right halacha is. But the truth is, on a micro level, on a smaller level, what this means is HaKadosh Baruch Hu cherishes and validates the ideas and insights that we bring to the Torah. Sometimes, you know, people say an explanation of something, and the response is, which commentary says that? Particularly if you have children who come back from yeshiva, you may often hear this type of response, meaning if we think of something or you think of something, you know, it has no value at all unless we could find it in some earlier source. Now, of course, I think one has to be cautious. If what one says is not found anywhere, like the example that's often given is that if you're not sure of your way and you're walking on a dark, lonely road and there's nobody that's walking along with you, you got to be a little suspicious. Maybe you got lost. When you're walking on a road, there's a lot of people there, so you feel a little better. Well, some say in Torah it's the same thing. If what you say is something that is well accepted, you kind of have a confidence you're on the right path. Otherwise, you know, you're all by yourself. So I'm not saying that maybe you should wonder, gee, why hasn't anybody ever thought of this? On the other hand, if it's true that every person has their letter in the Torah, then it's absolutely the case that a person can have an insight, an explanation, an understanding, which HaKadosh Baruch Hu will treasure and cherish because it emanates from your soul's perception of the reality of Hashem. And it is not to be dismissed just because, you know, it's not in some authoritative source. So even though I wouldn't say that we have this power over halacha that the Chachamim were given, but in terms of our power to try to understand the Torah, there is an individuality that we bring. But what this means is a very surprising thing, and I wouldn't tell my children because it may break fundamentals, but the Ten Commandments were not given on Shavuos. They were given the day after Shavuos. What happened on Shavuos was nothing. In other words, nothing. The Torah was not given on Shavuos, and that is why the Torah was given on Shavuos. That it was Hashem's deference to Moshe Rabbeinu's interpretation that was the real Matan Torah to Bnei Yisrael. This is what the Magen Avraham teaches us. Yeah.
Somebody comes to an Orthodox rabbi and he says, you know, you're right, your partner is not right. Then the partner comes in and he says to the partner, you're right. The woman is listening. She says, after they went away, she says, Sam, how come you told him he's right and him is right? So the rabbi says, you're right too.
You're right too. Everyone's right. Well, that's exactly it.
Chazal
say, Eilu v'Eilu divrei Elokim chayim. These and those, Beishamai and Beisilo, are the words of Hashem. They're both right because Hashem is much more interested in the process that we follow than in a particular result. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I want the cake that you make with me, not the cake that I bake and give to you. And this symbolism of becoming a partner with the divine repeats itself over and over again. It is of course the message of circumcision for the male is, you know, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates the male, you know, defective in some way, and the bris milah is the action of the human being in making it perfect. And Hashem doesn't create, at least the male, right? The women are created perfect in that sense, but the male is not created perfect, because Hashem basically says, become my partner in creating that type of perfection.
If what you're saying is true, then why is there so much battle between different philosophies, Orthodox Judaism? An Orthodox person knows that.
I think one of the lessons, one of the ways we deal with the problem of sinas chinam, hatred and polarization, is by recognizing the legitimacy of many, many different derachim. But, for example, all sorts of issues, such as what is our relationship to Zionism, to secular studies, to women's issues. You know, there are different types of points of debate and discussion. And one has to recognize that Torah does allow for different paths without condemning something as heresy or apikorsis. On the other hand, the dilemma is this. One can have respect and admiration for different derechim, but it might be important that one kind of decide in their own life what derech it is that they should follow. In other words, one should not be, as an individual, totally wishy-washy in terms of not having any standard that they follow. So the challenge is to, you know, incorporate what are the standards that I follow in my life, what do I feel is the best for my neshama and my family's neshama and my children's development, without disparaging necessarily the approaches that other people choose to follow.
But Rabbi Eliezer got excommunicated.
Yes, now Rabbi Eliezer. I do have to qualify that. And that is, so you might ask, in other words, there seems to be a contradiction in the story itself. That's a very excellent point. On one hand, the Chachamim say, we don't listen to you, God, because we came to our decision, and our decision has to be respected. So why doesn't that equally apply to Rabbi Eliezer himself, right? So the answer would have to be that lo b'shamayim means the Torah was given to the Chachamim to resolve. But one of the rules of resolution is that when you have all the sages in a single basin, you have to follow the majority view. So his problem was he refused to follow the human resolution, which is a majority. Now, that doesn't apply today. And the reason that doesn't apply today is we don't have a Sanhedrin that is sitting as a single body. If we did, indeed the minority view would no longer be legitimate. But in this day and age, all we have are the individual views of different people. And one has to find who is their gadol, who is their Rebbe, who is their authority, and one should, you know, be connected to someone. But that doesn't mean you disparage those who follow others. But you are correct. You're very correct in pointing out that on one level there is a self-contradiction in the story, but the answer to that is because there you had a Sanhedrin which could resolve these matters as a single body. Yep. Yep.
Yep.
No, it still does not. No, it still does not because of this. They left Egypt on a Thursday, so the Omer would be starting Thursday night. It would be the first Omer counting. So the last Omer counting would be Wednesday night. Okay? So Thursday night would be the beginning of the 50th day, which is Thursday night and Friday, but the Torah was not given till Shabbos, so it's still a day off. In other words, it doesn't help you, because if the first day of the Omer is Thursday night, Friday, the last day of the Omer is Wednesday night, Thursday, and therefore day 50 is Thursday night, Friday, the Torah was given that Shabbos, right? So you're still going to be a day off. Let me just end with one other thought. The Vilna Gaon says very beautifully that he goes on a side point. Rabbi Eliezer chose three miracles to try to convince the Chachamim. He chose the tree, he chose the water, and he chose the walls of the Beis HaMedrash. He's trying to convince the Chachamim of his superior competence to decide the halacha. And he says there are three qualities that a Torah scholar must have in order to be a Gadol b'Torah. Quality number one is he must be what is called mistapek b'mu'at, meaning to say he's not a person who needs a lot of material goods. If he's into wealth, possessions, property, physical pleasures, and the like, he will not have the concentration and devotion to the Torah. Now again, Judaism, as we know, is not an ascetic religion. Judaism does not preach the virtues of poverty, but it does recognize that the more one is involved in possessions, the less sensitive one is to spirituality. There is a concept of trying to simplify a person's life, not to be involved in getting more and more things. That is a remez to the Buxer tree, Charuvim, because charuvim is always a symbol of the most simple food. Right? If you have dried buxer and Tu B'Shvat, you are aware of that. It is certainly not something that's tremendously appetizing. It fills you up. And when the Gemara talks about people who are happy with very little, it often uses charuvim, kav charuvim. So that's the first thing. He's showing by that miracle that he is a mistapek b'mu'at. He is satisfied with very little. The second quality a Torah scholar needs is humility. Humility, because when a person is filled with their own ego and their own arrogance, and their desire for recognition and the like, they cannot be a conduit for God's will, because there's a blockage, meaning the truth that could come to a person is blocked by a person's own desires, right? This arrogance. Well, water is a symbol of humility, right? The Torah is compared to water, because just as water goes from the high ground to the low ground, the Torah leaves the arrogant and goes to the humble. So now here's a little bit of a contradiction. By showing the water moving, he's trying to demonstrate that he's a humble person. Now you might ask, how can a person show that he's humble? And he says, I am so humble, I'm going to make this water reverse its course. I mean, he's showing up. But the answer, once again, is if you understand what humility is, there is no contradiction. In other words, it is not contradictory for a person to say, I'm a very humble person, if he really means it. In the sense that a true anav is not a person who's trying to masquerade how humble he is. If he's trying to pretend how humble he is, he'll always walk with his head down and, you know, and say, oh, I'm nothing, I'm worthless. True humility means you recognize your strengths, you recognize your greatness, you recognize your talents, but you know that it all comes from Hashem. It is nothing for you to look down at people for, and with greater talent comes greater responsibility. So he could say, I am a humble person. I don't do these things for my glory. I do these things to serve Hashem. And if a person is honest and can actually say that, you can say that. It's not a contradiction. Although Hasidim like to tell a story in the early years of Hasidus, when they liked to show, you know, how the Misnagdim were all hypocrites, you know, some of the early stories. So they tell a story about Chassid who came to a city during Hakafas and Kastore, and he took charge of the Hakafas, and he announced, the next Hakafa are only for the humble people of the show. And of course, what happened was, everybody was fighting. Who do you think you are? I'll take it, you know, so, as if to show that this was kind of a fake humility. Now, so that's the second thing. Now, the third requirement that one needs is the diligence and enthusiasm to spend time, you know, learning the Torah and studying the Torah. Hasmada. That, of course, is alluded to by the walls of the... Hasmada. That is alluded to by the walls of the Beis HaMedrash. So in effect, he's trying to demonstrate that he has the quality of simplicity, the quality of humility, the quality of diligence, which is related to passion and enthusiasm, in just keep on working and working and working till he was able to understand the Torah of Hashem. So these are indeed qualities that we could also seek to cultivate in our own Avodas Hashem, the notion of simplicity, kind of getting rid of the static of life, possessions and other things that sometimes take away our focus, the midah of humility and the qualities of diligence, which includes enthusiasm and passion for what one is doing. And these are the qualities which can enable a person to be mekabel the Torah. Another way these three things come out is in Medrash. The Medrash points out that the Torah was given with three things. The Torah was given with fire. The Torah was given in water, because it was raining the day of Matan Torah. And the Torah was given in a desert. These three qualities are this way, because Eish, fire, is the quality of passion and excitement. Water is the quality of humility. And Midbar, which is very empty, is the quality of simplicity. Right? So you can look at it through the vantage point either of the Rabbi Eliezer story or through the vantage point of the Medrash that says Eish, Mayim, and Midbar. Those are the three variables for the Torah of Hashem. Yep. Because water goes from the high ground to the low ground. Water is always
a symbol. You said water, the Midbar, and what?
And fire, Eish. Hmm? Now, one other thing.
Midbar is Eish?
Yeah. Because fire was at Har Sinai, it says the sky was filled with fire.
But I want to ask you, are you true? You talked about humility, which to me is a very interesting subject.
Yeah.
What is Bitul Hayesh in the Kabbalah?
Kabbalah?
It's almost like what.
Well, Bitul Hayesh is an extreme form of humility in which there's abnegation of the self. You don't even regard yourself as existing.
And very hard
you look
to get.
At, you know, that's an extreme level of humility where the person literally has no consciousness of themselves.
Did any of the rabbis reach that height?
Well, at various times. I don't think people are in that level all the time, but there are moments in which there's Bittul. Because Bittul Hayesh is dangerous. Bittul hayes, the neshama could leave the body because you no longer see yourself as existing.
Where can you read more about the bittul hayes?
There are not that many books in English on those things. But, you know, any book on Kabbalah would talk about the Bittul Hayesh.
You can hold on to a table. Uh-huh. So that when he's dabbing,
not to separate.
You won't separate.
Yeah. I just want to say, and one more thing. The Vilna Gaon says another thing, an amazing twist. You know, why is Torah compared to water? And what we've been saying is the standard explanation that water is a symbol for humility. The Vilna Gaon says another idea. He says that water makes grow whatever is in a ground. If I have a plot of ground and I water it, if there's wheat seed, it'll turn into wheat. If it is weeds or poison, it'll be poison. Meaning, water brings out whatever is there in potential. So he says, Torah accentuates a person's personality traits. What does that mean? An amazing thing. If a person has kindness and compassion and generosity, the study of Torah will make him better, more kindness, more compassion, more generosity. But if a person learns Torah without consciously trying to improve their character, Torah is not going to improve their character automatically. It's the opposite. It's going to accentuate whatever distortion exists. If the person is arrogant, his Torah learning will make him more arrogant. If a person is egocentric, his Torah learning will make him more egocentric, which is why Rabbi Saul Salanter taught that one has to augment Torah learning with conscious work on one's personality and one's midos. Again, there were those who took the position that learning alone will purify you, but this Vilna Gaon shows the other way. And of course, the Vilna Gaon was certainly not somebody who didn't have respect for Torah learning. I mean, the Vilna Gaon learns 18 hours a day. In fact, the story goes that he was once at a wedding. He never slept more than a half an hour at a time. He slept 4 half-an-hour periods. And the story goes that he once slept 35 minutes or something. And he was very, very... He made a shvuah. He would never go to the city again. He says they cost him 5 minutes. And like 20 years later, he had to be there, and he only slept 25 minutes. So he says, Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me back my lost... last time.
Somebody said, only slept 3 hours a night.
They say 4 hours. No, it wasn't so light when he was older. He wasn't.
You can't go ahead.
Well, we can't compare. You know, he was not us. But so he was not someone who devalued pure learning, obviously. And yet, he talked about this need for midos and consciously striving to improve what he's getting.
Which midos would you recommend diving for to get yourself to a place where you don't feel compelled to follow the community of people around you, but to sort of be able to hold on to, like what you said, to respect other people.
Right.
Because there is a struggle in communities where, especially when you're new to Yiddish faith,
right,
that people want you to kind of go their way.
Go their way, yeah.
And other people want you. And I think everybody understands. I mean, it's just very hard and it's very wearing when you have sort of selected a way. But
right.
Respect everybody else's way, but it's not right. Necessarily the way of their community.
It's not reciprocal. Well, there are two things to be said. Again, you know, one does have to have a sensitivity to the way a community's norms. One does not specifically want to be, you know, the nonconformist. They're doing one thing, and I will always do the other. Because that's also conformity, right? To always say, oh, you wear red, I wear black. You know, you wear black, I wear red. But one of the things you need to do, you know, you need to pray to Hashem for patience. You need to pray to Hashem... not to respond with negativity, even if someone is responding to you with negativity. That's a tremendous bracha. You know, I remember reading that somebody said when they encounter difficult people, they should give a prayer of thanks to Hashem. Thank you, Hashem, for giving me the opportunity to improve my personality. Thank you, Hashem. You know, if all I would have are pleasant, easy to get along people, you know, I would never have a chance to improve myself. This gives me a chance to improve myself. It doesn't always work. But it is a kind of an orientation that you look at life as a bunch of challenges Hashem puts in your way. And every challenge is making you stronger. that particular way. And the accumulation of these little victories, you know, in time turn into something very, very significant. You know, it's something to at least aspire to. So I wish you all a very, very happy and meaningful Shavuos, and there should really be a kind of accepting the Chef's Torah.
Always enjoy it.
Yeah, next week I'll come.
No, I don't.